Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for Labor Day weekend. I know a lot of people will be podcasting this later because they're out doing things, but not Catherine, Tim, and I. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello. Welcome from Atlanta.
Yes.
Good evening.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a big show tonight. I know running for city council, Amir Farouki, he's going to join us in about 7:15, talk about his race. And then we'll probably go ahead and talk Atlanta politics up until then, at least, and maybe even after. Also, we're going to talk a little South Carolina gubernatorial race, Kentucky State Senate, a real interesting power play there. Might talk some congressional races in Georgia. And we have a Bobby Bright attack ad put upon him in Alabama. And we'll just play that and discuss that. And probably towards the very end of the show, we're going to go ahead and play some of those recorded pieces from John Brenneman and Shamari McKenzie that used to be enjoyed on Game On, but with the Armurchie Middle football team playing on Tuesday night, Game On has been on a little bit of a hiatus, so I want to still get those guys some airplay. But I guess let's talk about the really four, and hopefully we can get to them all, four events that happened in the Atlanta mayoral race. We had a candidate leave and a candidate come in. Catherine, you being the city resident on the panel, tell us who came in, who came out, what that means to the race.
I can't remember the name of the guy who
Glenn Thomas
stepped out of the race. It sounds like it was mainly because he couldn't raise money. He'd been pretty quiet, and, I mean, he didn't even really show up very much on the polls. And so, you know, he's young. He's got time. He can come back and run for something else. He's in his 30s, so hopefully he hasn't lost his interest in service and politics. And then the interesting occurrence on Friday, Kyle Kaiser, who is the co-founder of Atlantans Together Against Crime. That was a group that was organized following the shooting at the Standard Restaurant. When was that? Last winter. And he's been very active he's held rallies around town looking for solutions to Atlanta's crime problems. And about midweek, I heard through Facebook or Twitter or email or something that he was attempting to raise the qualifying funds to put his name in for mayor. And apparently he raised all the money, but kind of at the final hour, like he was able to raise it. I saw the note on Friday, so he did qualify, and so he's going to be on the ballot.
Yeah, now really, aren't these folks just trying to say who's going to be maybe fourth? I mean, fourth, like best case scenario for somebody that's kind of not Kasim Reed, Mary Norwood, or Lisa Borders.
I think you're right, though there's some talk that because he has this sort of following of people, young people who may not be involved in politics, that he might bring some new voters in, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, enough to overshadow the three front runners. But, you know, he might end up having some influence at some point. So, I mean, I think it's interesting when someone, as far as I know, he's never really been political. I've never met him or anything. So that's an interesting turn of events, I think.
Well, who does he cut, in your opinion, Catherine? Who does he hurt?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I don't know if he hurts anyone. He may just bring, you know, a new message and new people in, and perhaps he'll be able to, you know, have some influence when, you know, after the primary and say, hey, you know, I got all these people, what are you going to do about crime? What, you know, what, and maybe he's going to try to negotiate some support because he's got these people. I don't know.
Well, I mean, my theory on this is if you're going out to fight crime or you want something to be done about crime, you're probably going to vote anyway. So I don't really know that he brings that many new voters to the polls. I mean, this is not exactly the, hey, let's, you know, legalize marijuana crowd. That, you know, if somebody gets them organized, that's the first time they've ever been organized to show up. If you're kind of upset about crime, that seems more like the civic duty kind of person that's going to show up anyway, so that means he's bringing no new voters, essentially, and he will hurt somebody. I think that's the big question. Tim, what's your
question? I was going to ask Catherine the question about Glenn Thomas. Catherine, first of all, does him getting out either help or hurt anybody? And have you heard any inkling about who he might be endorsing in the race?
He didn't say. In the piece I read in the AJC, he didn't say who he was going to support, but he did say he was going to support someone and he would work very hard to try to get them elected. I don't know. I don't know that much about him, honestly.
Well, and honestly, if Catherine, you're a Atlanta citizen that does a political talk show, one of the founding members of Georgia for Democracy, on the state committee of the Democratic Party, and you couldn't even remember the guy's name, how many votes can this guy really bring?
I don't know that that's valid. There's a lot of people in Atlanta that I don't know.
Well, no, but I'm just saying, if you can't even recall the guy's name. I mean, how much name recognition did this guy
I think that was the problem. He didn't have name recognition. And he even said in the piece I read in the AJC that it was hard to get people to support him when he wasn't that well-known. So, but maybe he'll make an effort to get more well-known in the coming years, and then he'll come back and run for something later. Let's hope he does. I mean, I have a lot of admiration for people who – you know, step up and decide to serve, unless they're Republicans, of course.
Well, and you have to start at a
that was a
you
joke.
Have to start at a lower down race. I mean, look at the three leading candidates.
Exactly.
Two
well, I you know I believe that.
And
yeah.
A state senator. They've started a lower position and they've worked their way up. So I mean, that's something to think about. It now in other news, in the mayor's race, Mary Norwood got an endorsement from, I believe, Representative Wong.
Uh-huh.
In South Atlanta, who's African American, and this comes on the heels of the memo, the racially charged memo of the two Clark Atlanta professors, I believe. Do you think that was very newsworthy, Tim?
The memo, nah. You know, I don't think it's shaken the race up or done anything to the race.
Not just the memo, but the fact that an African American legislator in South Fulton, which is not her base, endorses her, does that do anything to the race?
I think you have to be very careful about what you think is her base.
Yeah.
She has base all over the city.
You're talking about Representative Long. Now, interestingly enough, he represents an area in southwest Atlanta that ought to be either right close to Catherine or maybe the district that Catherine lives
right.
in. So Catherine could tell us more about the particular voters this man would represent and if he could bring some of them to the table. Catherine?
Well, I think the district that he represents is actually a little farther south than me, and it's a relatively, I believe, if I've got the district correct, there's quite a bit of crime over there. It's hasn't really gotten the rejuvenation that some other parts of Atlanta have gotten. And I have to, you know, I think I've said this before on Kudzu Vine. I know I've talked with my friends a lot about it. There's a lot of support for Mary Norwood over here in southwest Atlanta. There's signs all over. She has been very active over here. She's been, you know, working this city well for the last 2 years in anticipation of this run for mayor, and also because I think she really wants, you know, she works the whole city. And so I think it's dangerous to assume that just because a neighborhood or a part of the city is predominantly African American, that Mary Norwood doesn't have support there. I think that's a little bit dangerous.
Yeah,
she's got support over the city.
I got my anecdotal evidence back in April. I went through the West Paces Ferry area, which is
absolutely. She's absolutely got support up there.
Then I went down to the south of Summerhill on the way to Westlake High School, and there was Kasim Reed signs everywhere. And I think this may have been at the time in which Lisa Borders either was out of the race or had just gotten back in, and that's why I based that, you know, very limited amount of anecdotal evidence on that.
Well, mine's anecdotal as well, except that, you know, I think I've said before that in the last 18 months I've gotten like 6 or 8 invitations by phone to coffee, you know, little coffees or, just roundtable discussions with Mary Norwood in my neighborhood, invited by people who live here to their homes. And I've gotten nothing like that from Lisa Borders or from Kasim Reed. So I think she's really been working the neighborhoods, trying to get, you know, broad-based support around the city. So,
now,
I mean, you're absolutely right that when you go up, you know, Buckhead, North Atlanta, you see a lot of Mary Norwood signs. But you see them down here, too. They're not.
And Catherine, let's be fair. Now, if somebody doesn't drink alcohol, they're called a teetotaler. I'm sure there's a term if you don't drink coffee.
Well, okay.
Maybe they don't drink coffee.
Well, okay, teas. Tea party.
Maybe they'll like hot beverages. No hot beverages. You can't have a Sprite. You know, you can't have a Sprite in a meet and greet, you know. But the last Atlanta topic that I want to talk about is there was an internal poll for the Kasim Reed campaign that showed some movement. I know, Catherine, you had talked about no movement in this campaign, or none for really Kasim Reed. It was like, where was his support? Well, it did show a little bit of movement. Basically, he is in a virtual tie with Lisa Borders, which she would have dropped in this poll, and I think other polls have shown that part. And then it still said that Mary Norwood was on top. So we're fixing to hear about a but.
But, man, it's an insider poll.
It is.
It is done by his campaign. We've seen no other polling data to back this up. Don't you think we would have to consider this poll an outlier until we do?
Yeah.
Well, I will say this. It was done by Brilliant Corners Polling, who did the Marshawn Chrysler race. And they were the ones, and they kind of mapped out what was happening as far as polling in his race. Remember, he went from like fourth, fifth place way down in Jackson and then made it into the runoff.
Okay, let's play devil's advocate here and say this is true. Why?
Well,
why has he suddenly made this movement?
The question is, can be a two-part question. Why has he made this movement, or why has Lisa Borders fallen? And I get the sense that the second's just as true. Catherine, any answers to any of those questions or points?
I've been mystified by his lack of support, or you know, the polls for him, and I don't know if it's just because he doesn't, you know, he's been serving in the state senate in a part of Atlanta, but not all of Atlanta, so he must just not have name recognition. But I wish I had an explanation for it. And as far as the internal poll of his. You know, it's a reputable polling firm, but it is his people. So I wish I had a good explanation, but I don't.
Yeah, I do agree about that it is his poll, and so it has to be, you know, looked at in a certain way. It needs to be verified then by an independent poll.
Absolutely.
Local news source, the Atlantic.
Absolutely.
Has no money to do extra things like polling. I don't know who this will come up on to do a poll on this race in independent fashion, maybe one of the television stations, because I know they're doing some polling, or maybe a Insider Advantage or Strategic Vision, maybe our guest last week, Dr. Shapiro, maybe they'll do some kind of poll just to, you know, get a little idea of this race, even though they don't do political work.
You know, there is one other thing, though, about this, guys. Even in his internal poll, Norwood scores very strongly. this would have to clearly indicate that she's the candidate to beat, right, Catherine?
Absolutely. I think there's at least
the primary.
Do you agree
with that, David? I would think you would say she has reserved seating to the runoff.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's really who's going to be in the runoff with her, and that becomes, you know, the next question. In some ways, it looks like. And I guess the one more thing about the Atlanta City Council race, of course, the two professors that wrote the poll, not the poll, the memo about the mayor's race, their names were revealed. Now that people know their names, Catherine, is there any different sense in the Atlanta circles that you talk in?
Well, let's just make that clear. They didn't write the memo. They wrote the report that the memo was written following, right?
Okay, so explain the difference to a layman.
Okay, well, they were either hired or asked to write a report about the mayor's race and how, and I believe the impact on African American leadership in Atlanta. And so they submitted the report to whomever it was that asked them to. And then this Atlanta Leadership Forum or whatever they were called, the guy affiliated with that wrote the memo. So they didn't write the memo, and they've been very careful to sort of distance themselves from that memo. I don't know that it really matters. I think everybody sort of dropped it. I don't think there hasn't been nearly as much conversation about it. You know, it's sort of mentioned at the end of stories this week during qualifying. It was mentioned, you know, that it happened, but I think it's sort of lost its luster, and I'm glad about that. I think it was a little bit provocative and not all that helpful, in my opinion.
So you don't think it'll have any impact on the race?
I don't think so.
Not the memo itself. Well, I guess let's welcome our first guest on, or our only guest tonight, running for city council, Amir Farocki. Welcome, Amir.
Good evening.
Yes,
hello, Amir.
How are you all? It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, yeah. Well, for folks that listen to our show or read blogs that people were on the show write on, like Catherine Smith, you're not a stranger, but go ahead and tell us about your background, Amir.
Well, thanks, Dave, for having me on the show. I'm thrilled to be with you all tonight. I was listening a little bit earlier to the y'all's debate on the mayor's race. I will say at the outset, I'm staying out of the mayor's race. I'm focused on my race. But it will be interesting to watch, whichever way it plays out. I am born and raised here in Atlanta, and I am the son of two educators. My mother, who's an eighth-generation Georgian, is from Augusta, Georgia, and she ended up in Atlanta in the 70s, as did my father, who came to the U.S. from Iran, and they met both doing graduate work at the time in Atlanta and ended up staying. And I am a lawyer by trade, and I jumped into the city council race about a year and a half ago. And we are running full steam ahead 7 days a week. I left my job or resigned from the firm I was at about two months ago and have been campaigning full-time since. The seat that I'm running for is one of three at-large seats on the council, and it's the seat that's being vacated by Mary Norwood, who, as you all know, is running for mayor. And so we've built what I think is a strong citywide campaign. It seems to be resonating with voters. And I'm thrilled about where we stand today. Of course, the challenge is in a down-ballot race is to get your name out there as many folks as possible because so few folks pay attention in city races, particularly as you get down the ballot.
Yes. So running for that seat at, citywide, how does that change the campaign, having to run all across the city instead of just in one particular area of the city?
Yeah, it creates a, you know, it's a much bigger bite of the proverbial peach, I suppose. Financially, we have to raise a lot more money. In a district race, you could probably raise between $50,000 and $80,000 and outwork your opponent by knocking on every door and run a very strong, robust campaign. Now, we can't knock on every door in a citywide race, so we've been working hard on the fundraising front to raise enough to do the direct voter outreach we want to do the last few weeks of the campaign to touch as many voters as we can that we may not have been able to talk to by that time, and we're working hard to talk to as many as we can. And then strategy-wise, there's competing views. I take the view that if you're running for a citywide seat, you need to run a citywide campaign. There's some folks who say, well, you should just focus on areas that are your strengths, and there may be some strategy to that. Personally, I think if you're going to be a strong at-large council person, you need to know what's going on in all aspects of the city, and you need to be in just about every neighborhood. So we're working hard to do that.
Yes. One final question before I pass it around. I'm on your site, and I went to the Issues tab, and you have 15 different issues you talk about, and that's very commendable, having that many issues touched on. But when people come up to you or ask you questions at your events, what issue is most important to the average Atlanta voter?
Yeah, I think that it depends on where you live in the city, what may be at the top of your list. There's a few common threads that I've heard and that I believe are at the top of voters' list. Public safety is probably the most often mentioned issue. You know, I live in an area where there's a tremendous amount of property crime. There was a high-profile murder right across the street from where I live. And I think there's a sense across much of the city that the city has never really put the resources into making Atlanta a truly safe city. And that comes up in conversations in affluent neighborhoods and underserved neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods. There is a growing frustration that the city is not putting enough resources into the police and fire department and into after-school activities and to rec centers as well to keep young folks out of trouble. The second biggest issue that I hear voters talk about almost universally is wanting to see not only greater fiscal transparency from City Hall, but wanting to see much greater fiscal accountability and eliminating inefficiencies that have been made larger given the shortage in revenue this past year that a lot of big American cities have faced. And so those are two big issues. You hear a lot about transportation as well, which is a big issue of mine. You know, how do we begin to transform how lands move around the city? Not from a regional perspective, but just inside the city limits. What can we do to change our street life and connect our neighborhoods and make this a much more walkable, bikeable city? And you look at some of our peer cities, you know, Charlotte's a good example. They are moving much, much quicker with much greater political will to say, look, we're going to connect our city through modes of transit other than a car. And Charlotte's really good about saying, or at least their politicians are really good about saying, you know, well, what do we want to be? Well, we don't want to be like Atlanta. Let's do the opposite of that. And they are very quickly proving to be a very well-run city and a city with a great deal of foresight. And I don't want us to lose ground in the region, much less in the country, by being less than proactive on a lot of these issues.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Catherine, an Atlanta resident, so you can get her questions.
Hi, Amir. It's so nice to have
Catherine.
You on tonight. I just want to tell everybody that's listening that I am a supporter and a financial contributor to Mr. Faroki's campaign. Just make sure everybody is all clear about that. But I think I am going to ask you some
questions. Are
going to be harder. I think I'm going to ask you a couple of tough questions. I wasn't at the stand-up rally the other day, but I did read some of the reports. I talked to some people who were there. And one of the things that really struck me that I heard, and it wasn't from you, but from H. Lamar Willis, who's running for city council president, is that right? Or is he just running for city council again?
He's running for re-election.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I guess he said at the stand-up event, this is an event that was held in Atlanta the other day, and many of the candidates were there. He said that he wants to close the city jail, that it would save $38 million a year. That's all I heard. I'm just really surprised by that, because we know that, like, the Fulton County Jail is constantly embattled and overcrowded. So is there any, like, validity to that comment? I mean, is it something we can really do?
I don't recall. They had us sequestered for each candidate's time in front of the audience, and I don't recall if I was in the audience when Councilman Willis was giving his responses. And I will say that, you know, one thing the city has to look at, you have to ask Councilman Willis as to where he was going with that.
Well, I was just asking if that's like a legitimate, is that something that would help solve any of our problems, both fiscal and public safety?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, you know, we have to start looking at how do we run an efficient government that serves residents well, but also serves city workers well. And one area which we can begin to eliminate inefficiencies, if it may want to do so if it serves residents and taxpayers well, is to reduce the redundancy of services between, say, City of Atlanta and Fulton County. And one topic that has been brought up is the sale of the city jail. I don't know about the closing of the city jail. I don't think we can close the city jail. I think we could sell it to, say, Fulton County to run a much more seamless
Oh, I see. That makes sense.
And that would free up, I've heard, you know, upwards between $30 and $40 million, kind of a one-time sale fee. From what I understand, most of the arrestees arrested by the City of Atlanta Police are taken to Fulton County anyway, and that there's a much, much smaller percentage of perpetrators who are arrested are taken to City of Atlanta jail, and there's a lot of vacant space and a lot of redundant services. And so there has been some talk of consolidating those two, since the City of Atlanta relies heavily on Fulton County anyway.
Okay. And now, what? Of course, you know, we're all concerned about crime, both as it affects our personal daily lives and as it reflects on the reputation of Atlanta and drawing visitors and conventions and all those kinds of things. What do you see as some of the possible solution or paths to alleviating some of this crime?
Yeah, this has been a topic of the campaign, whether it's the mayoral campaign or the council campaigns, for most of this year, and I think it rightfully so. We have to be careful not to talk about crime and public safety in a silo. It's not just about the police department. It's not just about the fire department. We need to look at the continuum of crime, both in how the prevention of crime, the enforcement of crime, and then the judicial system as well. And there's so many moving parts and so many different jurisdictions, I suppose, that it's tough to create a comprehensive vision without stepping on someone else's toes. But I would suggest that the city needs to do a couple of things. The first is to put together an education liaison. There's not a lot of conversation between the City of Atlanta and Atlanta Public Schools. I'd like to see the City of Atlanta be much more proactive in either engaging Atlanta Public Schools or pushing APS to really bolster their after-school programming. You see a lot of the crime that's being committed right now is being committed by young folks who should be in school or who, had they been otherwise occupied by something productive, whether academic or otherwise, may not have found themselves in a position to now be committing crimes. But that's part of it. You know, the other part of it is the city needs to keep open its rec centers and parks, which are also good diversions for young folks who may not be in school or may not have someone to watch after them after school. The police department, though, is a big challenge. We have 1,650 officers, plus or minus a few, for a city of 530,000. And we've had that number of officers for the last almost 10 years, and our population has grown by 100,000. Now, by comparison, Washington, D.C. has 590,000 residents, and they have over 3,000 officers. And I'm not saying, you know, the cities are apples to apples. There are probably some differences you'd have to look at. But we have drastically fewer officers than we need for a city of our size. And there has to be a concerted effort to say, okay, if we're going to prioritize what services we provide, we need to put public safety at the top of that list and begin to either create dedicated revenue streams for funding public safety or find ways to generate new revenue or eliminate efficiencies to create new revenue to make sure we have the number of officers we need in the city, and that those officers aren't sitting at desks, but that they're visible around the streets, either on foot patrol or car patrol or bike patrol. And then we need leadership of the department that is much more willing to step forward and address the public and to lead the city on a public safety or on a commitment to making this the safest big city in the country. But it also, we also need leadership that's going to inspire morale and the rank and file. You know, I went on a ride along with some Atlanta police officers 2 weeks ago, and there were a whole number of complaints from pay to the level of technology and their equipment. But you know, one of the more resounding ones was this kind of almost sorrowful appeal of saying, look, you know, we really want leadership that understands what we're going through on a day-to-day basis, that isn't afraid to come out with us on patrols or to come out with us at road stops so that they understand what's going on in the rank and file. And I don't think we've seen that from the current chief. And whoever the next chief is going to be, we need to have someone, and it may be from within, but someone who inspires rank and the rank and file and also is approachable to the general populace.
Well, thank you. I think I better turn it over to Tim. I don't want to take too much time.
yes, sir. I just happened to have been in Atlanta yesterday to attend the Georgia Tech game, and the way I went to Tech took me right by Atlanta's Waterworks. Oh, by the way, somebody put out some nice yard signs for you in that area. Just wanted to throw that in. But what hit me suddenly was, wait a minute, here is a huge issue to the people of Atlanta, water. Over 40% of the people in Georgia live within 50 miles of the state's capital. How is the city of Atlanta ever going to be able to address this water problem that the state of Georgia seems either unwilling or unable to do anything about?
Well, I will say this. The city of Atlanta's residents heeded the call last year to conserve water. And
we paid for it.
And this was rewarded by, and this has been already said in some before, but by a three-year tiered increase in water rates. And we've just had the second increase this year, and we now have the highest water rates in the country. And, you know, it's kind of the city said on one hand, well, we want you to reduce your water consumption, and on the other hand, we're jacking water rates to get us back to where we were when we were using more water. So I will say residents of the city have been very good about conserving, particularly when the drought was in effect. This isn't just an Atlanta issue, and the city of Atlanta, we have to remember, is 530-some-odd thousand residents in a metro area of 5-plus million. And this is a regional issue, and it is even bigger than that. We know it's a state issue. And it's going to require leadership at the state, whether from the legislature or hopefully from the governor's office, that says, look, the answer isn't just fighting with Florida and Alabama and trying to keep as much of the pie as we can. It's creating a culture of conservation in the state that either rewards conservation or incentivizes conservation through rain barrels and other public service announcements that show people how they can use less water so we're putting less drain on our natural resources. So, I think it hasn't been a topic of conversation in this year's city races, and that being water. But it's going to be a major challenge for us the next 20, 30 years. Businesses will decide whether or not to stay here or to relocate here, as will residents, whether or not we have drinking water or water to run the manufacturing facilities. And so we have to figure this out quickly because we probably dropped the ball 10, 20 years ago and just tried to get as much of the pie as we wanted to rather than saying, well, we know we're going to have to share. We only have to look to the western part of the country to see that states who fought for decades over water there have come to water sharing agreements and have worked things out in the long run. And we need to get to that point as well because if we don't get our act together as a state, Atlanta is going to really, really suffer down the road, and we're going to lose our stature and fall behind cities like Charlotte and Nashville and Denver.
Okay, and you have also said on another subject, the subject of transportation, you have said that no city has become a great city by relying on the car alone. What does public transportation need to do in Atlanta to achieve the kind of global status that a city like Atlanta would deserve?
Yeah, I would tweak that comment a little bit. I think what I've said is there's no great livable city in the world that is dependent on car. We could probably find some great cities that are only car dependent. I mean, some would argue that Los Angeles is a great city or that Shanghai is a great city. They are in many respects, but I wouldn't say they're the most livable cities in the country or in the world. And I think that should be our goal. Like, how do we become the most livable city we can be, ideally the most livable city in the country? And we have to be much more progressive in our transportation options and increase transit options for folks. And ultimately, this is going to require a regional solution with state backing and state funding and federal funding to put in the necessary infrastructure that we need for commuter rail and streetcars and expansion of MARTA. However, I think the city of Atlanta, and the city of Atlanta is handicapped a bit because, you know, it's 530,000 some odd people in a sea of 5 million in the metro area, so it can really exercise the bully pulpit that effectively in the grand scheme of things. However, I think the city should be able to lead by example and say, within the city limits, we're going to begin to transform how we move around Atlanta. And that's doing a lot of little things, right, that don't require major infrastructure, but require a stronger attention to detail and to design, urban design. And that's making sure that there are ample sidewalks in our neighborhoods and in our commercial districts, that those sidewalks are taken care of, that they integrate well with the street and aren't just putting people right next to a road where cars are driving by at 50 miles an hour. It's making sure there's a comprehensive sidewalk plan, comprehensive bicycle lane plan, and that's implemented as soon as possible. It's synchronizing traffic lights so folks aren't sitting in their cars longer than they
should be. Amen to that.
It's pushing transit-oriented development around existing MARTA stations or existing transit nodes. The Lindbergh development's a good example of more of what we need. And ultimately, we're going to need a good east-west transit options, that it may be better MARTA bus lines that are easier to pick up, and the bus stops are easier to read and to navigate, or maybe streetcars at some point. And the Beltline factors into that, the Peachtree streetcar corridor factors into that. But we need to focus on making it easier to move around Atlanta, connecting our neighborhoods, because this isn't just a transportation issue. It's a public health issue. It's an economic development issue. It's a neighborhood development issue. It touches on just almost every issue that faces the city. And that's going to drive our tax base. It's going to determine whether or not people want to live in the city, if businesses want to relocate to the city and stay in the city. So that's our big that's the Atlanta-centric bucket. And then I think on the state level, the city needs to be probably more conciliatory and nuanced in its lobbying of the state. You know, and the city does a very good job reaching out to the state and saying, look, this is what we need to either fund MARTA or expand transportation options. It's fallen largely on deaf ears because of a rural-urban divide, and we don't have a governor who really embraces anything other than the car. I mean, you look at the GOT, the GDOT logo, and it says GDOT, and then behind it are highway dashes. You know, there's no indication of trains or bicycles or anything else that may move folks around. You know, this is still a very highway-centric Department of Transportation we have in the state, and that has to change. And we just have to look at North Carolina. Look, North Carolina is a state that is similar in size and population, demographics to Georgia, but they've been much, much more progressive on just about everything we do, from transportation to education to energy. When President Obama said, look, we're going to make money available for rail, for shovel-ready projects, North Carolina had done all the studies and environmental impact studies and all the planning years ago, and we haven't. And we're going to find ourselves at the short end of the stick in a lot of respects if we don't get our act together on transportation in the state. And the city has to help usher that forward, but I fear that we're not going to have significant change in funding for transportation, new transportation infrastructure in the city and in the region until we have a governor who is able to lead us in that direction.
Well, I don't say this to every guest we have, Mr. Faroki, but that was one outstanding answer. David?
Well, now that you've got Tim's stamp of approval, we were going to let you go ahead and get some votes with that. If somebody wanted to learn more about your campaign or volunteer or donate to your campaign, how could they do that?
They can visit my website. It's amirfaroki.com. I realize that's probably difficult for a lot of folks to spell, so I'll spell it. It's A-M-I-R, and then F as in Frank, A-R-O-K-H-I.com. Or you can give me a call, 404-290-3347. We're always signing up volunteers and taking ideas and advice. And growing this campaign every day. And then we also have campaign headquarters on Ponce de Leon, at the intersection of Ponce de Leon and Highland, North Highland. So feel free to come by any time and talk, and if you want to volunteer, we have more than enough things to do.
Well, best of luck in your campaign, and thanks for being on the Kudzu, Vonimir.
Thanks for having me, y'all. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to listening to the rest of the show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Happy Labor Day.
Same to you. Yeah, well, it's good to have Amir come on, and I will agree with you, Tim. He was very, very well informed, and that's good to see.
Boy, I'll say.
that are informed and know about the issues. Because, you know, really, you need to put study forth if you're going to run. And I tell you another thing. I come across a lot of candidates that they just don't want to – they want to run, but they don't want to say anything about anything. And while I will say I haven't clicked on every single issue, I mean, just the fact that he addresses 15 issues, maybe there's only, you know, a few bullet points on that, but just to think about and say, like, you know, this is where I stand on this or that, I mean, that's pretty impressive. There's more things I'd like to have asked him, but I just know that, you know, his time was limited, and then, of course, you know, we have other topics if we're truly going to be a Southern show. And in that vein of being a Southern show, I want to move over to Alabama. There was a attack ad put against Bobby Bright from the National Republican Campaign Committee. I'm going to play that ad. And then we're going to tell our thoughts about, is this effective, was this a good ad? So everybody listen up.
I'll tell you what's wrong with this country.
Here we go again.
It's Nancy Pelosi.
Well, you got a point there.
She's wasting trillions of dollars.
That's right.
Raising energy taxes.
Yes, sir.
Deficits as far as the eye can see.
Uh-huh.
And now health care.
Gonna screw that up, too.
Even some Democrats are tired of Nancy Pelosi.
Come on.
One Alabama Democrat congressman says he cannot support her anymore.
What about our Democrat congressman?
Bobby Bright?
Bobby Bright.
Bobby Bright is sticking with Pelosi. Bright votes with Pelosi 70% of the time.
Bright votes with Pelosi 70% of the time?
Yes, he does.
Well, if Bobby Bright is voting with Pelosi,
then he isn't voting with us.
Call Bobby Bright at 202-225-3121. Tell him not to vote with Nancy Pelosi on health care. The National Republican Congressional Committee paid for and is responsible for the content of this advertising, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. www.nrcc.org.
Okay, that was the spot. Now, I don't want to cloud anybody's judgment with my opinion. Tim, was that effective?
You know, I think that it probably was effective. I noticed a couple of things in that. First of all, they attacked Nancy Pelosi and not the president. And secondly, this the old reliable Democrat Party, not Democratic
yeah.
Party, naturally. But all in all, yeah, I think it's a pretty effective attack ad, David. I got to be honest, and honestly, if I were in the GOP ad business, that's something like that's what I'd throw over there in Alabama. They're a very red meat state, and that was very red meat.
Okay, well, that's your thought. Let me get Catherine's before I give mine. Catherine, what do you think?
Well, sure, I think it was effective. You know, it's the kind of ad that people respond to because it sounds like two ordinary guys just talking, you know. But the thing that I found interesting about it when I listened to it before and then now hearing it again is that if you didn't know anything about government, you might think that somehow Nancy Pelosi is able to spend all this money and do all these things all by herself. And I just think it's interesting that, I mean, it's good. I think it's effective to personalize these things, but it's not accurate. Of course, that never stopped anybody.
Yeah, well, no.
But that's the part that I, just as an inside baseball kind of person, I was like, well, you know, it's not just Nancy Pelosi who makes these things happen, but...
No.
But I agree with Tim. It's effective. And I think the fact that it's, you know, two guys having a conversation with the little, you know, country music playing in the background, I think makes it one of the things that makes it effective.
See, I thought it was kind of patronizing. I thought that it sounded like, you know, Enos and Cooter there, you know, talking. And I don't think the average South Alabama citizen wants to see themselves as Enos and Cooter off of, you know, some TV show from 20 years ago. You know, talking about the Dukes of Hazzard, I just think that it didn't. It's kind of like, you know, Alabama voter, you're not real sophisticated. We think you can do this. Another thing, you know, they chose to attack Nancy Pelosi, and I did notice that too, Tim. But I'll tell you what, I remember Matt Towery saying one time that, you know, he would tell them because a lot of Republicans wanted to attack Tom Murphy in the State House, and he said, you know, well, first thing we'd have to do is we'd have to go out and spend $1 million to teach them all who Tom Murphy was before they could even get mad at him. I don't know that a lot of folks, and that's kind of sad, but I'm sure there's a lot of folks aren't really sure who Nancy Pelosi is.
Now, I'm gonna throw you some facts out there, David, to show that that is not correct. This is a Rasmussen.
So tell
survey.
Me her name ID rating. I'd like to know.
92%.
Wow. I'm actually glad that it's 92%.
She is the best known and least liked of the congressional leaders. 57% of voters have an unfavorable view of her. And those who have a very favorable opinion of her are beaten by those who have a very unfavorable opinion of her by a 5-to-1 margin. Conservative voters, by 80%, have a very unfavorable opinion of her. So
okay,
they're kind of playing to the band.
The NRCC folks are doing their research.
I will say one thing. I think that we've all heard over the years that men criticizing women is not as effective as women criticizing women. I think it probably would have been more effective if it had been women's voices.
Yeah,
maybe.
Really, it sounds
that's
like the two kind of guys that hate Democrats anyway. That Democrat, Bobby, you know, it sounded like guys that Bobby Bright, you know, two guys he didn't get the first time anyway.
Yeah, he's
so
not
he
gonna
really
get him
gonna, he ain't going to get them next
yeah.
time anyway. So that's one thing. Now, I will say this. I'm actually glad that 92% of the people know who she is, because if you think about it, this is, on paper, the most powerful woman in the history of the United States. No woman
right.
has ever achieved an office this high, and people should know who she is. I mean, her achievement is very much the equal of what Barack Obama did. I mean, the highest woman ever to serve, you know, in the Speaker of the House. In a lot of countries, Speaker of the House is the highest office because it's like the, you know, the head of parliament in many countries. So it's really an impressive feat. So it's good they know. I just am surprised that sometimes they do because it just seems like she doesn't get as much attention, probably because there is, you know, the
I
president.
I think she got this kind of name recognition because she happens to be the first female House Speaker,
yeah.
don't you?
That
yeah,
may be part of it.
And she's out there. You know, she's on, you know, on TV, and she has been very prominent at the last two Democratic conventions. And, she's a prominent woman, and she's also very recognizable. She's very well, you know, she's very presents herself very well. So I think people remember her.
I thought Catherine had gone moderate or conservative on his team. She said, she's out there. I was like, whoa,
no,
Catherine.
Well, that's why I had to pull that back a little bit. No,
she's out.
But, I mean, she's out in public a lot. She's on TV and she's on the radio, and people talk about her a lot, of course. You know, Rush talks about her all the time.
Oh, she's on a first-name basis now with Rush. I think she's going closet on us, Tim.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, well, Well, let's go ahead and move to another topic, and that was Kentucky. I was very interested in the article of what their governor, Steve Beshear, I believe that's how you say his name, what he's done up there. He has taken the Republican majority leader in the state Senate, and he has appointed him to a judicial post. And people might, and so, of course, on the surface, oh, yeah, he's being good bipartisan, appointing Republicans. But that opens that political seat up. He takes him and moves him to a non-political seat and then opens up that political seat, which apparently is more of a swing district, so Democrats can win. And they say that he's doing this seat by seat. He's going to dismantle the Kentucky State Senate from a Machiavellian perspective. This guy is just, I mean, I'm in awe of him. Catherine,
I love it. I love it. It cracks me up. The guy wanted the seat. You know, he said months ago that he wanted it, and so he gives it to him, and then he gets all this criticism from the Republicans. If he'd nominated a Democrat, they would have given him grief, too. So good for him. I mean, he pulled a Crist, or he pulled what we thought was going to be a Crist.
Yeah,
remember
what
we talked
the...
a couple weeks ago about Crist nominating that guy, but I thought it was brilliant, and I think it's hilarious that the GOP is just all up in arms about it. Well, the guy wanted the job. And he appointed a Republican. I mean, it's very strategic.
Oh yeah, yeah. Tim, your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, I really do think he has this plan. The Republicans right now have a 20-17 lead in the state Senate, and they have blocked a significant portion of Governor Beshear's program. And there was no other way he could get rid of them. So, hey, let's start appointing him to some stuff. And he's already taken this out for a spin, David, and it worked. You know, a few months ago, he used this tactic when he appointed another Republican in Senate leadership to the Public Service Commission up there. His seat came open, and guess what? When they had a special election, a Democrat run the seat. He's picking these Republicans in these swing districts and giving them these powerful positions. And I agree with you, David. I got to admire this. This
yeah.
is great.
Yeah. Wasn't there a post that President Obama was going to appoint a Republican to, and the Republicans said they wouldn't do it on the national level? Am
yeah,
I remembering that correctly?
That was a senator from New Hampshire up there, Judd Gregg.
Judd Gregg. And
out.
He thought about taking it, then he didn't. And that's the same kind of thing, although – I don't know, you know, you can say that these Kentucky Republicans are more out for themselves, or maybe they're not so partisan. I don't know what you want to say, but I just thought that was fascinating. And then we're going to come back to Georgia, and there's, well, two congressional races that I want to talk about. The first was up in the 9th District, what we thought would be a special election, but probably it's just going to be a regular primary and then a general, supposing the Democrats filled a candidate. But up there, they came out with the first poll, and it showed that one of the Gainesville candidates, I believe his name was Mike Evans, is in the lead. And then Tom Graves, who I kind of thought might be the front runner, is running third. And the second candidate, maybe Lee Hawkins, I don't have the poll in front of me.
Lee Hawkins was actually leading with 12%, and Evans had 10, and Graves had 9.
Yes, and so, I mean, that's all kind of margin of error stuff, but I still was surprised, given that the other two were kind of splitting the eastern half base, and Graves had, kind of has the western half to himself. Tim, what did you think of that poll?
Well, you know, a guy I was surprised about, and he's pretty well known, is Bill Stevens. He's hardly showing up at all in this thing. And a lot of people would look at this, and they would know who Graves is. They would know who Evans is. But unless they live up that way, they would say, wait a minute, who is this Lee Hawkins person? I doubt very seriously if somebody over here in Lafayette knows who Lee Hawkins even is, and he's leading the race. And the other observation is, wow, these numbers are low. Over half the voters in the district had, you know, no opinion or no favorite candidate. So I got to wonder a little bit about
that. Well, if you
can
raise some money off of it, that's to get more votes, that's the best thing you can do with this poll. I wouldn't say, man, let's sit on this lead, because obviously it's not big enough. Catherine, what did you think about this ninth district poll?
I was surprised by those numbers, like Tim said. You know, it just seems like a lot of undecideds, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of races that way. Well, now we go from Lee Hawkins to another congressional race that may even not even be a race, the more you look at it. But there was a rumor, and that's the best term I can give it, a rumor that DeKalb County Commissioner and friend of the show, he's been on our show before, Lee May, might run for Congress against Hank Johnson. Apparently there was a church meeting, and something was said in some way to say that Lee May was interested in Congress. And it became this report that made its way to AJC, Peach Pundit, I don't know what other news sources. I guess, what's the one, the Crossroads News and DeKalb?
Yeah.
Catherine, you know a little bit more about this. What do you know?
Well, the way I understood it, I was really quite surprised when I saw that in the Political Insider, because I know Lee, and I actually, the last time I saw him was at Congressman Johnson's town hall event. And I was, like I said, I was surprised to learn. I mean, he just got elected to the commission. Is it even been 2 years? I don't know exactly when it was, but I learned through through a friend who knows him, and through I heard through the grapevine, I guess I should say.
You mean the kudzu vine?
Well,
we're in the south.
The southern the southern grapevine. The Atlanta grapevine, Atlanta Metro grapevine, that he isn't necessarily planning on running now, and that unfortunately Mr. Galloway didn't even call him to get his comment on the situation. Now, he did say in the Crossroads News that he knew as soon as he mentioned it at his church meeting that it would probably get out. That wasn't his intention. But it sounds to me like he's contemplating this, but probably not in 2010. But I haven't spoken to him about it either. But I was a little surprised that Mr. Galloway would not even bother to call him. Of course, we also had Mr. Galloway do that around that Jane Kidd rumor about her running for Senate. And there's been some other things recently where Galloway didn't really follow up like you might expect a newspaper man to do. So I was disappointed that he didn't give Commissioner May an opportunity to explain himself, though I may be wrong. He may qualify and run in 2010. I don't know, but it sounds to me like it's more of a forward thinking, you know, maybe in the future I want to do it.
Yeah, and saying I might like to be in Congress one day, it's very different that I'm going to run this year.
Exactly.
And in the two cases, one is a race in need of a candidate, and then you kind of latch on to rumors a little quicker. I mean, I don't know that this is a race in need of a candidate, because anytime somebody runs, particularly an interprimary battle, it's what is this congressperson doing or not doing that needs to be done? What are you not getting? And I don't know what people are not getting from Hank Johnson that they won't. I get the sense that there's not much that they're not getting. You know, when Cynthia when he beat Cynthia McKinney and Denise Majette beat Cynthia McKinney, it was kind of like the whole, you know, the narrative was she didn't take care of DeKalb and Rockdale County. She worried about, you know, looking at big issues, you know, from her perspective, but not taking care of the little stuff of the district. And therefore, that's what both of those candidates were able to run on and beat her. I don't see that he's given enough of an opening to anyone at all.
But, you know, they actually did talk to him, to Congressman Johnson, and he said, well, I'm always ready for opposition. I don't expect to run unopposed every time, and I'm ready whenever anybody runs against me.
Yeah,
so,
and these races are these districts where it's very one-sided, be it Democratic or Republican, a lot of times you will see more, you're right, everyone or all but about 50 seats. Those races tend to get more primary challenges because I guess people just feel like, one, they're not going to hurt their party, and then, two, it's kind of like, well, this is where my opportunity is.
And not that's necessarily
a good strategy. And that very well, like we said, may not be Commissioner May's strategy. It just may be that he said he was interested in the future and this thing's got blown out of proportion. But, guys, been a great show, and next week we're going to have Stacey Edmonds, who's running for Rob Talay's House seat. Next time she's going to be one of our guests. We don't know what else will be planned for the show, but as long as there are topics, we're here. But once again, let's go ahead and just leave the people with John Brenneman's piece like we did last week as we close out. But until next week, this has been the Cuzzy Vine.
Happy Labor Day.
Good night. Good evening. I'm Triple Action News anchorman Reed Page. Triple Action News has learned that Cuba is suffering from a near-epidemic toilet paper shortage, with many residents forced instead to utilize newspapers, sugarcane husks, and Ernest Hemingway novels. The shortage has frayed existing tensions between the U.S. and its island neighbor. But now sources say a Russian submarine crammed with 8 packs of communist black market Charmin is just off the Florida coast, heading for Havana. President Obama has ordered U.S. naval vessels to block the Russian sub, escalating the so-called Cuban toilet paper crisis. The White House wants to be sure the Russians aren't using humanitarian reasons to smuggle a nuke into the impoverished island nation. U.S. paper products have always been difficult to obtain, but now Cubans have little or no access to such local brands as Havana Soft, Che Guevara Ultra, and Revolucion No. 2. The most popular substitute is said to be a government pamphlet touting toilet paper conservation. Other shortages plaguing Cuba's 11 million inhabitants include Philips Milk of Magnesia, Madden NFL video games, and basic human rights. When we return, Fox News nutjob Glenn Beck is claiming that the wildfires ravaging Southern California are part of President Obama's plot to turn America into a black Nazi welfare state. For 13 o'clock news, I am Anchorman Reed Page.
So the GOP is considering Dick Cheney for president in the year 2012. Wait a minute. Dick Cheney, as in former Vice President Dick Cheney? Shoot you in the face, Dick Cheney? Yes, him. Oh, no! Oh, no! Oh, no! Wait a minute. Cheney 2012? Landslide for Obama. Oh, yes. Come on, seriously. Do Republicans think they can win with this guy? Seriously? Let me get this straight. Your top dogs are Bobby Jindal, Sarah Palin, and now Dick Cheney, in no specific order, but those are your top dogs. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory. I tell you one thing. I'm thinking about jumping parties. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I can easily win the Republican nomination. I can actually run for president. I mean, come on. You got these losers running. Why can't I throw my name in the hat? Hey, they need somebody who's cool, calm, and extremely handsome. That's me. That fits me to a T. Well, I don't know. I don't think I could do it. I think I could never turn my back on Democrats. I'm a Democrat to the core. Yeah, that's a bad idea. But come on, Dick Cheney. I'm Shamari McKenzie from Washington, D.C. I'll talk to you next time. And also, farewell to Senator Edward Kennedy.